Hello, you're listening to a Zen Studies Society podcast. To learn more about our community of Zen Buddhist practitioners, please visit zenstudies.org.
Zen Buddhism by the numbers. Number six. Six paramitas. Sila, ethical discipline. Is that so? From 101 Zen Stories, transcribed by Nyogen Senzaki and Paul Reps. The Zen master Hakuin was praised by his neighbors as one living a pure life. A beautiful Japanese girl whose parents owned a food store lived near him. Suddenly, without any warning, her parents discovered she was with child. This made her parents angry. She would not confess who the man was, but after much harassment, at last named Hakuin. In great anger, the parents went to the master. "Is that so?" was all he would say. After the child was born, it was brought to Hakuin. By this time, he had lost his reputation, which did not trouble him. But he took very good care of the child. He obtained milk from his neighbors and everything else the little one needed. A year later, the girl mother could stand it no longer. She told her parents the truth, that the real father of the child was a young man who worked in the fish market. The mother and father of the girl at once went to Hakuin to ask his forgiveness, to apologize at length and to get the child back again. Hakuin was willing. In yielding the child, all he said was, "Is that so?" Good morning, everybody. Getting later in the morning. It's good Rahatsu weather. Not the best. Best would be snow falling down and cold. That pushes you inside. We're affected by the elements. Rain, damp. It's good for going inside, but the best for going inside is snow. Forgive me for having to wear this mask. I do it out of caution for everybody. I don't know who I might have been exposed to and who I might expose. If anyone has trouble hearing me because of the mask, please make some sort of gesture to let me know, and I'll try to speak louder and more clearly. So, I was wondering, this is a question that I've been pondering a little bit, and I've come to my own decision about it, but I want to get everybody else's opinion. Who here believes that we have free will? Anyone? Good. Good. That is a very good way of thinking about things, a very Buddhist way of thinking about things. Who here acts as if they have free will? Yeah, this question of free will, it's a myth which is very popular in the West. The whole idea of right and wrong, certainly in Christianity, it's a very fundamental idea that we have free will and that we choose to sin, to act against the will of God, and that this is what makes us liable to punishment. The matter has been debated for probably forever. Recently, there was an interesting book published by a neuroscientist named Robert Sapolsky called Determined. And the point of that book is neuroscientific evidence running counter to the idea of free will. Based on what we believe about reality in Buddhism, the question of free will shouldn't really be a question. We know that all phenomena are conditioned. This lectern is an expression of the conditions of sun and rain and soil that grew into a tree that was later cut down by some person or some machine and fashioned into this lectern. All of the conditions that had to exist for this lectern to come into being and to sit here, I don't even know where to begin to talk about them. The people involved in the harvesting of wood, the people involved in the fashioning of wood, the society which makes it possible for commerce to occur, and then somebody buying this lectern or gifting this lectern, and somehow it ended up here. A huge number of occurrences just to have something to put our texts on. And of course, the same thing is true for each one of us. This body that we have, each individual body, was the result of endless events in the past. And all of our thoughts and all of our senses, again, shaped by conditions, our prejudices, our opinions, our ideas, all shaped by conditions. And so, in a fundamental sense, it's silly to take credit for any of our accomplishments, because all of our accomplishments are essentially just the fruition of conditions. And the same thing for our failings. In a fundamental sense, it's silly to beat ourselves up over our failings, because just like our accomplishments, they're the result of conditions. That being said, there are delusions which are helpful and there are delusions which are harmful. And the delusion of free will, as long as we don't take it too seriously, is a helpful delusion. We have to act as if we had free will. I mean, why do we chant the great vows for all if in fact we have no choice in the matter? However innumerable all beings are, I vow to save them all. However inexhaustible delusions are, I vow to extinguish them all. However immeasurable Dharma teachings are, I vow to master them all. However endless the Buddha's way is, I vow to follow it. This vow is very important. It's so important in our practice and in our lives. We have to act as if we had free will. Because this vow is what enables us to move forward to accomplish the way. In last night's Rohatsu exhortation, Hakuin Zenji was saying how important it is to have a great vow. And that's absolutely true. Even if that great vow, like every other idea, mania, obsession that we have, is simply another expression of conditions. Still, we have to have absolute certainty that this vow is our vow, that we are undertaking it, and that it's our business to see it through. Fundamentally, we know that this is a delusion. Fundamentally, there's nothing to be accomplished. And yet, it's very important that we act and take responsibility as if there were. It's a wonderful paradox. And this brings me to the topic for today. The six paramitas, of course, dana, generosity, sila, ethical discipline, kshanti, patience or perseverance, virya, energy or exertion, jhana, meditation, zen, and prajna, wisdom. To take any one of these paramitas on its own is like taking a single thread of a tapestry and trying to make sense out of it. You really can't do it. And yet it's helpful sometimes for us to look at things very closely at the risk of losing the forest for the trees, or the tree for the leaf, or the leaf for the stem. And so, this story that I related to you from 101 Zen Stories, is that so? I've always loved this story. It's such a wonderful story, and it's such a wonderful expression of what Buddhist ethics is really all about. And just like I said that you can't take just sila, ethical discipline, and look at it without examining the tapestry of all of Buddhism. just this one topic brings me to talk about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the 16 precepts, the Great Vows for All and the Three Treasures, the Three Pure Precepts or fundamental precepts, the 10 Important Precepts. All of these things play a role in understanding ethical discipline. So, when I say 16 precepts, usually we think of 10 precepts. The other six are the three treasures and the three pure precepts or fundamental precepts. And really, the 10 precepts are just, in a sense, it's nitpicking. If you understand the first six, the three treasures and the three pure precepts, the other 10 are just self-evident. So the threefold refuge, the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, Buddha, you can think of Buddha as your own true being. You can also think of Buddha as a figure to whom devotion can be offered. So in a sense, you're offering devotion to that part of you which is most real, most fundamental, most alive. You can pray to Kanzeon, chanting Kanzeon. And this is just one aspect of Buddha, and it's just one aspect of your own true nature. And yet, in human psychology, it's important to have a relationship. The relationship between the self and God, what Martin Buber called I and thou. Obviously, relationships amongst other people. And a relationship to what can be called the divine or the awakened condition. And taking refuge. It's an interesting phrase to take refuge. We don't use it in very many other contexts. You take refuge from a storm, from the vicissitudes of life, from danger. You take refuge from suffering. You take refuge from chaos and perturbations of the soul. You might say, in some translations, Eido Roshi's translation was, I give my life to the Buddha. You might say, I abide. I rest in the Buddha. It's a condition of trust, like a child trusting its mother. It's a condition of security, the Dharma. I take refuge in the Dharma. The Dharma can mean the teachings of the Buddha, or it can mean the fundamental reality that those teachings describe. I take refuge in what is real, what is not make-believe. I take refuge in knowing that I don't have free will, knowing that all of the suffering that exists is not my fault. It's simply an expression of conditions. Even though I take responsibility for putting an end to not only my suffering, but all suffering. Take refuge in reality. And I take refuge in the Sangha, the community. In the most narrow sense, the Sangha is the community of like-minded practitioners. All the people in this room and all the people in the Zen Study Society, all the people in Rinzai Zen, all the people in Zen of all kinds, all the Buddhists. But of course, it's much more than that. It's all people everywhere, all beings everywhere. And the connection, the very real connection between all beings, past, present, and future, including you, your past self, your present self, your future self. If your future self is the product of conditions, then what your present self is doing lays a very important groundwork for those conditions. And even if there's no free will, you can dedicate yourself to training your body, your mind, your heart, opening yourself to compassion, opening yourself to wisdom. You can act as if you have free will and choose to engage actively in training your heart, training your mind. And that's what we're doing here. That's all we're doing here, really. Doing Zazen, doing Kinhin, eating in silence, doing our jobs, whatever our jobs may be. All of it is simply training your heart and training your mind, training your body, creating the conditions of community, of love, of sharing, of openness and wisdom. And the four great vows and the threefold refuge are just two sides of the same coin. All of those vows are simply expressions of our relationship with Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The three pure precepts, I love them because of how simple they are. And there are a lot of different translations out there. I think, to paraphrase someone, Roshi, he said, "Don't do bad things, do only good things, and purify your heart and mind." This is the fundamental teaching of all Buddhas. Don't do bad things, only do good things. Don't do harmful things. Sometimes it's translated as, don't create evil. But I think it's much simpler. And the last of the three is the guide for the first two. At all times, purify your heart and mind. And again, that's all we're doing here. That's all we're doing here. That's all that Zazen is purifying your heart and mind. All of the pain, all of the sleepiness, all of the effort, it's just purification. Sometimes to purify impurities requires fire, a really hot fire to melt away all the impurities. And that's what Rahatsu is. Just a hot fire to melt away, to reveal what's underneath. So with that as an introduction, let's go to the story, Hakuin. The Zen master Hakuin was praised by his neighbors as one living a pure life. That's nice. It's always nice to be praised, you know? Everybody likes that. It's great to have people think that you're wise, that you're kind, that you're considerate, that you're a moral person. That's good. He was praised by his neighbors as one living a pure life. He was Hakuin, aside from being the fierce character that we think of, he was always kind and generous to those around him. He would go out to the people in the surrounding village and teach them in words that they could understand, using simple language and simple actions to teach the villagers. It was a very nice relationship that he had with the surrounding villagers. A beautiful Japanese girl whose parents owned a food store lived near him. Suddenly, without any warning, her parents discovered she was with child. This tells us a few things. First, it's a beautiful Japanese girl. Not a young woman, but a girl. Maybe she's 13, 14. A child, really, who is in trouble. That was the phrase that people used to use for people who would get pregnant out of wedlock. Well, she got herself in trouble. And she's in trouble. Her parents are furious with her. My goodness, what is she going to do? Her parents badgered her. Who did this? Who did this? The girl wouldn't tell. Maybe she loved the person that did it and was secretly hoping that he might marry her. Or maybe she was raped. Who knows? The story doesn't really give us very many details. However the case may be, she couldn't bring herself to name the person involved. And finally, when she couldn't take it anymore, when she was being badgered too much, she said, It's that priest, Hakuin. Why did she do that? Maybe it was the only person that she could think of that she felt safe with. Who knows? In Bodhidharma's outline of practice, he says, to enter the path by practice refers to four all-inclusive practices. Suffering injustice, adapting to conditions, seeking nothing, and practicing the Dharma. Suffering injustice. In a sense, she was suffering an injustice. Poor, young, single. Perhaps she barely knew what she was doing. And suddenly, her life is turned upside down. But certainly, Hakuin was suffering an injustice. The furious parents brought the child to Hakuin, yelling at him, screaming, look what you've done, look what you've done. What are we going to do about this? What are you going to do about this? Hakuin, seeing the parents, seeing the baby, said, it's not so. He doesn't admit to anything. There's nothing to admit to. He doesn't defend himself. I said that ethical discipline, you can't really unravel it from the Eightfold Path. And of course, one of the most important in the Eightfold Path is right speech. Is it helpful? Is it true? Is it kind? Is it the right time to say it? Hakuin, seeing the condition of the child mother and the parents and the baby, knowing that to defend himself and to call the girl a liar would be like throwing gasoline on a fire. He says only, is that so? Not yes, not no. Is that so? Leaving space for the girl to have some dignity, for the parents to vent their anger without making things even worse. So he suffers the injustice, but he suffers the injustice with great equanimity. Is that so? Not, well, what am I going to do about this? Is that so? Adapting to conditions. There's a child who needs to be taken care of. There's a girl who needs time and space to recover from trauma. And the harsh realities of her life. And so, acting from compassion and concern, Hakuin takes the child, arranging for it to be well taken care of, obtaining milk from his neighbors and everything else the little one needed, not seeking anything other than the well-being of all parties involved. Well, this is a perfect expression of Buddhist ethics. A perfect expression of entering the path by practice, which is just another way of saying ethical discipline. That kind of equanimity comes from long years of purifying the heart and mind, of seeking nothing, of relying on Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, taking refuge. If your refuge is Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and your practice is kindness and purification of the heart, mind, then it doesn't really matter if other people think badly of you? Hakuin's reputation was ruined. It's nice if people praise you. Not necessary. If people think you're a buffoon, people think that you're lecherous, a hypocrite, whatever they think of you, if you know that your only desire is to purify your heart and mind, and to act with kindness, then it doesn't really matter whether people think you're the greatest or they think you're a bum. You can be a happy bum. By this time, he had lost his reputation, which did not trouble him. But he took very good care of the child. This is a good example of how one can defuse a situation if one doesn't care how one looks. It's kind of the opposite of the usual situation in police confrontations. When somebody is dead set on commanding respect and being in control, that's when things can spiral out of control in disastrous ways. If you realize that you don't have control, but can adapt to circumstances, adapting to conditions, being open to conditions, and without an agenda to make yourself the hero. Then things can be diffused. And that's what happened here. A year later, the girl mother could stand it no longer. Her conscience could no longer allow her to blame Hakuin. And so she went to her parents and told them the truth. The real father of the child was a young man who worked in the fish market. And again, there must be a lot more to the story. Who knows what her relationship with the young man might be? Perhaps by this time they've decided to make a go of it and to get married. Who knows? All we know are the bare bones of the story. She could no longer take the shame of having accused a good man. The mother and father of the girl at once went to Hakuin to ask his forgiveness, to apologize at length, and to get the child back again. Hakuin was willing. In yielding the child, all he said was, "Is that so?" exactly the same line. That's really all I have to say about this particular story. I wanted to share another story with you from the 101 Zen Tales. Actually, I'll share two stories. They're very similar stories, and they're both very short. The thief who became a disciple. One evening, as Shishiri Kojun was reciting sutras, a thief with a sharp sword entered, demanding either his money or his life. Shishiri told him, "Do not disturb me. You can find the money in that drawer." Then he resumed his recitation. A little while afterwards, he stopped and called, "Don't take it all. I need some to pay taxes with tomorrow." The intruder gathered up most of the money and started to leave. "Thank a person when you receive a gift," Shishiri added. The man thanked him and made off. A few days afterwards, the fellow was caught and confessed, among others, the offense against Shishiri. When Shishiri was called as a witness, he said, "This man is no thief as far as I'm concerned. I gave him the money, and he thanked me for it." After he had finished his prison term, the man went to Shishiri and became his disciple. This goes along the same lines I was talking about diffusing a situation. As long as you have no agenda for yourself, situations are not hard to diffuse. And by allowing space for people to work out their karmic conditions, sometimes wonderful things can happen. This compassion, allowing the space for people to discover who they are, is so important. Not demanding that they change, not demanding that they feel shame, but allowing space with dignity and respect. And the next story is very similar story. When Bankei held his seclusion weeks of meditation, pupils from many parts of Japan came to attend. During one of these gatherings, a pupil was caught stealing. The matter was reported to Bankei with the request that the culprit be expelled. Bankei ignored the case. Later, the pupil was caught in a similar act, and again, Bankei disregarded the matter. This angered the other pupils, who drew up a petition asking for the dismissal of the thief, stating that otherwise they would leave in a body. When Bankei had read the petition, he called everyone before him. "You are wise brothers," he told them. "You know what is right and what is not right. You may go elsewhere to study if you wish. But this poor brother does not even know right from wrong. Who will teach him if I do not? I am going to keep him here, even if all the rest of you leave. A torrent of tears cleansed the face of the brother who had stolen. All desire to steal had vanished. That story speaks for itself. I have nothing to add. It's getting on. There's still much work to do. Take good care of yourselves. Be kind to yourselves. Be kind to each other.
This has been a Zen Study Society podcast. If you found it to be of interest, please consider making a donation by visiting zenstudies.org/donate. Thank you for listening.